that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. Be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourriza, with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its ongoing raids in the West Bank. First off, a reminder of the most recent developments. Dozens of Palestinians killed, dozens more wounded in the latest attack on Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. The humanitarian crisis is deepening as nearly 2 million displaced Palestinians are having to cope with scarce tents, food, and water. Oxfam and Human Rights Watch accuse the Israeli regime of using hunger as a weapon of war. In what looks like an escalation, Israel has targeted Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has killed at least 19,667 Palestinians since October 7th. Hundreds more have been murdered in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem in the same period. So where do things stand right now? Are we on the cusp of another ceasefire despite intensified Israeli strikes? What's the plan for post-onslaught Gaza? And has the genocide in Gaza brought Palestinian factions closer or not? Let's tackle those questions with Tarek Othman here in the studio with me. Tarek is a London-based Palestinian who has family in the West Bank. Alongside him, via Skype, also from London, academic and analyst Ibrahim Jamal. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Tarek, let me begin with you, just to kick things off. Your thoughts on the fact that 2.5 months later, since it all began, we're here talking about the ongoing genocide, that it's taken so long for the world leaders to begin to talk about a longer truce?
Well, there's a lot of mixed feelings about it. Of course, the fact that, 75 days or so now after the beginning of a mass slaughter, a mass starvation of 2 million people, it's still to the point where calling for a ceasefire is, just about on the cusp of what is politically mainstream. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do think that it shows a great resilience on the part of the Palestinian people. To have survived what I don't think anyone, and me firstly, would be able to survive. I think something like 50% of the people in Gaza are currently starving. And yet we still see that after 75 days of that, there is still resistance, there is still community, and there are still some very awe-inspiring visions and videos coming out from Gaza. And so that, in a sense, it's instilled me with a sense of pride because of the fact that we mm-hmm. have been able to mm-hmm. to maintain that.
Let me put the same question to Ibrahim as well. Your thoughts, Ibrahim, on the fact, again, that 2.5 months since it all started, we're still seeing that genocide unfold before the eyes of the world, with countries that can put an end to it right now if they wanted to, but won't.
Yes, more than 18,000 have been killed, including 7,700 children. We've seen bombs dropped on hospitals, schools, religious sites, mosques, churches. But more than that, the nature has changed. We've seen journalists being targeted. We've seen an elderly woman and her daughter being sniped in a Catholic church in Gaza City. We've seen high-ranking officials, yes, the Latin Patriarch, of Jerusalem as well as Pope Francis, I believe. We've seen high-ranking Israeli officials, including Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, and Energy Minister Israel Katz. They've made public statements expressing their aim to deprive civilians of food, water, electricity, and fuel. This constitutes two crimes of humanity. These are war crimes, and under the statute, Article 7 of the Rome Statute.
Yeah.
So these are indirect contravention of international law and standards, and it is a crime against humanity.
And Ibrahim, let me ask a second question. While, for example, the likes of Ben-Gvir, Itamar Ben-Gvir in the Israeli cabinet, are calling for quote-unquote military decisiveness, which means basically continuing with the slaughter of Palestinians, the president is saying that Israel is open to a ceasefire and a prisoner and captive exchange. What do you think is happening in the so-called war cabinet in the Israeli regime?
Well, the war cabinet, the individual leading them is Netanyahu. This is a man who's been charged with corruption, embezzlement. His wife, according to original indictments against Sarah Netanyahu, she's been indicted of a fraud and breach of trust. So she also embezzled around $100,000. They were filmed dining at a non-kosher restaurant in London, Gordon Ramsay's, whilst passing a law to prohibit hospitals giving out a particular type of bread in hospitals. So we're dealing with a hypocrite. We're talking about someone who embezzles and corrupts. And this is supposedly the leader of those that he serves. So he's absorbed these terrorists and criminals to form a coalition government. And more than that, the Israeli government, the Israeli people have voted for him. According to a recent poll, 60% of Jewish Israelis, the IDF is not using sufficient force. So everything that we've seen is not enough. And the most telling and the biggest indication is when we heard of three Israeli hostages who were practically naked, holding out under a white banner of surrender
and speaking Hebrew.
Exactly. So what more defenseless individuals could you face for them to be gunned down? What more do you want? So those are those people. Imagine the Palestinians who are in a school. You've got snipers waiting outside. And these are all under the orders of the war cabinet.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned snipers, Tariq. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you have family in the West Bank. This is an atrocity, an aggression that is not limited to the Gaza Strip. There are snipers in the West Bank, the occupied East Jerusalem as well. What are you hearing from your loved ones who live there as we speak?
There's a great sense of anxiety because it's a situation now where many of the Palestinians are extremely fearful of the settlers who live near them, who, enabled by the Israeli occupation or army, are carrying out slaughters of Palestinians. They will ransack villages, they will destroy homes and cars, and they will attack random civilians and their farmland. But more than that, there's been a great increase in the confiscation of land. There's been an increase in the demolishment of homes that Palestinians have built, and there's an increase in the ethnic cleansing of many Palestinian communities, especially near around Hebron and Safariyatta. And in these areas, Palestinians now faced with increased Israeli terror, which are acting on the basis that the media has focused on Gaza and so therefore allowed them to get away with much more. And the settlements, of course, are not slowing down whatsoever. In fact, they're increasing.
Recently they announced funding for the building of another settlement.
Yeah, so there's, Palestinians in real time in the West Bank are seeing their freedoms of movement controlled by Israel. Many Palestinians and many Palestinian villages are completely isolated from villages 1 mile away and cannot move, cannot go out to get food and water, Palestinians in villages like Jenin have faced daily raids where, you know, dozens have been killed in a single day. And that's, of course, in the West Bank, where Hamas does not have any strong goals. Hamas does not have major political control. And it shows, I think, a large-scale domination campaign carried out by Israel, and that has been carried out, of course, for the last 75 years.
And all, of course, with the blessing of its Western backers, about which one we're going to hear. The U.S. is still engaging constructively, quote-unquote, with other members of the U.N. Security Council on the text of an Arab-sponsored resolution to spur desperately needed humanitarian aid deliveries to Gaza during a halt in the fighting. Of course, that according to a U.N. State Department spokesman. UN Security Council members were in intense negotiations Tuesday on a resolution trying to avoid another veto by the U.S. The vote, postponed till December 20th, had been expected to take place by early afternoon on December 19th, but was later canceled as the U.S. asked for more time. The State Department spokesman also reiterated Washington's new position against settler terrorism in the occupied territories. Have a listen.
We are engaging constructively with our colleagues on the Security Council to resolve outstanding issues related to that resolution. We fully support addressing the humanitarian needs of the people of Gaza, as this resolution should set out to do, and we're working through these issues with other countries on the Security Council. We have made very clear to Israel that we think they need to do more to police and prevent extremist settler violence in the West Bank, and we have taken our own actions to hold extremist settlers accountable when they commit violent actions, and we will continue to do that. We will continue to speak both loudly from here about it and directly to Israel.
Matthew Miller there, the U.S. State Department spokesman. Tara, I think I want to put this other question to you as well. One of the things we heard the Americans say was they're going to impose sanctions on settlers for committing violence against the Palestinians. Probably a lot of them already have American passports. I wonder if those sanctions work. The UK has said something along those lines. How do we square that with their billions of dollars in military funding to Israel and their diplomatic backing and all of that?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that it's a vain attempt to save face in a way and to pretend as if they are making constructive efforts. Of course, they are militarily backing Israel, and they are sending, you know, arms that are, as we speak, being used to bomb civilian targets in Gaza. But more than that, I think it won't, I don't know how many people it will affect, because in order to subscribe someone to be a terrorist, there are, you know, in Israel, you'd expect courts to decide that and to delineate someone as an extremist. But in Israel, the courts will not do that. You know, I believe something like 93% of cases opened against extremist settlers in the West Bank are closed without even an indictment, never mind a charge or a conviction. So what we are seeing is this will not have any effect whatsoever, and it's really an attempt to placate people who maybe aren't as aware.
And Ibrahim, same question to you. Maybe UK related. We saw that resolution, that amendment to the King's Speech brought forth by the SNP, the Scottish National Party, for calling for a ceasefire, was struck down by the Conservative Party, of course, along with members of the Labour Party. And yet you hear comments such as the ones we heard from Foreign Secretary Lord David Cameron, saying the same thing as the Americans have said, that they're going to slap sanctions on Jewish settlers.
Yeah, these leaders, which they don't deserve to be called leaders, both in name and position, they are sheeps in sheep clothing. The Israeli lobby is very powerful and organized. I don't know what it is that they hold on them, blackmail or whatever it is, for them to be complying with them and just unconditionally supporting them. I wonder to what extent, you know, what has to be done for them to say, No, and it just seems to me that the only thing that trumps their loyalty to Israel is their loyalty to themselves. I mean, countries in America and here at the UK, there is no shortage of problems that we face. We're talking about homelessness, accommodation, we're talking about immigration, crime, stabbings. All of that has been set aside, and they use our tax money to support a criminal entity. Yeah. I just don't understand. I'm flabbergasted, and I don't know what it's going to take for people or for these leaders to put a stop to this, dealing with Israel. You know, basic stuff like stop sending arms and why allow? I don't understand
Israeli,
why we allow
weapons manufacturers out of the United Kingdom. That's one way to do
yes,
it.
Yes, but more than that, why is it that we have UK dual nationals, you know, going over to Israel, and these are people that support crimes against humanity and have committed war crimes, serving in the IDF or being spokespersons, yet a Palestinian faces so many obstacles going over to his homeland, to his ancestral land, and if they do give any money or funds, they're labeled as terrorist sympathizers or fundraisers for terrorists.
Exactly.
I don't understand.
It does defy belief. It really does boggle the mind. Tarek, I want to pivot to the humanitarian crisis. People, of course, are being bombed 24/7. People are dying as we're speaking. But the humanitarian situation, the catastrophe, is deepening by the day. Oxfam, Human Rights Watch, we'll be talking about this, of course, later on as well, have accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war.
Yes.
What do you think is the thinking, really, in Israel, behind denying people food and water and electricity and supplies such as that?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question to answer. There are a couple, I think, possible explanations. The first is that the Israelis on October 7th went through a very big shock in a lot of ways, and many Israeli civilians did die. And to Israelis, in order to have a sense of victory, many of them, and this has been very clear from videos that have come out of Israel, do feel the need that they need to inflict 100 times greater pain against the Palestinians in an act of collective punishment, in order to perhaps, you know, as one Israeli commentator has said, in order to sleep at night, he wants to see houses of civilians
kill 100,000.
Yes,
we've all
exactly.
seen that video.
Yeah, it's unfortunately very commonplace, and I doubt that commentator is going to have any repercussions for what he said. And another explanation, of course, is that the resistance amongst Palestinians, in all forms of resistance, is so entrenched that in order to stem resistance and in order to impose your domination against the Palestinians, you need to in essentially cut off the basics of life in order to then cut off the basics of resistance. So far that hasn't worked, and the past 75 years of the ethnic cleansing hasn't worked in stemming Palestinians away from confronting their occupiers. But it does seem that in the Israeli mindset, and in fact in the mindset of a lot of occupiers and colonizers throughout history, has been to confront any opposition to them with demonstrable violence
and brute force.
Brute force.
And you know what? It's been the occupiers and the colonizers who had to leave in the very end.
I think that's what's given me a lot of hope. We've lived through 75 years of, you know, perhaps not as bloody, but definitely the same mentality. And just as, you know, approximately half of the Palestinians today might be expelled from Gaza, and that's their intention. We've already half of the Palestinians have already been expelled in 1948. You know, thousands of Palestinians have already been dying. So this is really just more of the same in that sense. And in that sense, I do feel like just as we've survived that and we've come back and we've you know, cemented our identity. This too would only cement our identity and cement our love for our land.
We're seeing that playing out every single day. Now, Ibrahim, we see there with that contribution earlier that resistance and solidarity are coming in many different forms. What would you say, if anything, to someone who wants to get involved in the pro-Palestine movement but is afraid of the potential blowback?
Yes, that poem was eloquent and moving. So someone who wants to get involved, I would say write petitions, petition your local council. You can also download apps like No Thanks. This is an app that lists boycotted products, any products that are affiliated with Israel. So what you do is you would scan the barcode and it will automatically tell you if it supports Israel by giving funds, if it's complicit or not. More than that, the app, you can donate money. Now, I've got friends in Gaza and they are in dire need of assistance, food and water. But when I did go to give money, he told me, you know, there is no food. So what are we going to do with the money? So before anything, something has to change on the ground. And attending protests, raising funds, these are all ways that we can show, we can convert our emotions into political action. They do have a place and they do matter.
Absolutely. And Tarek, in addition to what we heard Ibrahim say, there are other people who are saying one of the ways to keep the pressure on the government to take some kind of action would be to take direct action.
Yeah.
As we have seen groups such as Palestine Action do so, which was to lay siege to Elbit Systems, the Israeli weapons manufacturer that has several sites in the UK, to their sites and try to shut them down.
Yeah.
And they have managed to do so in the case of two. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's very inspiring. I have to one of those particular sites. I was there with a Palestine Action allied group. It wasn't Palestine Action themselves, but it was the same sort of idea. And I saw with my own eyes how effective it was. You know, we're at the point now where no single one of us is going to have the ability to single-handedly end the genocide. But there's a very interesting quote that I've heard that I always think about, and it's, "I can't do anything alone," said 7 billion people, and that's the idea. But there's a lot, I think, you know, popular movements and movements directly targeting factories, for example. I mean, factories shut down for a day. That's one day's less of drones or sniper scopes that haven't been made. And on top of that, I think it's more than that, more than whether it's effective. It's, you know, what kind of person would you be if you slept through a genocide?
Exactly.
Whether it's effective or not, doing something, doing interviews, protesting, doing direct action, for me at least, is what allows me to, is what I think I'll be able to say maybe in 10, 20 years when I've had my own children, I'll be able to say, you know, your dad wasn't entirely useless.
Or I did what I could in my capacity
exactly.
to bring about change.
Exactly.
One thing I've heard, Ibrahim, is pro-Israel commentators and others calling into question the accounts that are being provided by the different UN bodies, the so-called Professor Alan Dershowitz of the University of Harvard, if I'm not wrong, saying the Red Cross, UNICEF, UNRWA, they're all in the pockets of Hamas, in not in his exact words, but you know that's pretty much what he was trying to say. Why do you think they're doing that, discounting and undermining the accounts of the scale of death and destruction coming out of the Gaza Strip?
Their rhetoric has become much more extreme. You know, anyone that's against them and anyone that's not with them is against them and is a Hamas sympathizer. Also, the medium in which people consume news now, before, where in the past it was just through the television. Now we've got social media, we've got people with phones, and you've also got Israeli soldiers showcasing their depravity to the world and smiling about it. So these are undeniable truths, and people resonate when they see individuals being massacred. Gaza has lived through, I think, four wars previous to this. Each one has gotten worse, and the population has become younger and younger. Mm-hmm. And the rhetoric of people like Alan Dershowitz is that Hamas recruits child soldiers, and the fault is on Hamas. So, and we see a shift in their rhetoric becoming more extreme, you know, and these are, they don't hold up to academic scrutiny.
They make those comments because they have no argument. They have lost the argument. All right, fascinating conversation, gentlemen. We're fresh out of time. With those comments, we're going to wrap this show up. Many thanks again to my guests for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack, we'll be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime continues to pound Gaza by air, land, and sea, killing scores of people from individual families in what has become a horrific daily occurrence in the long-suffering territory. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, in mid-November, rights experts said that the Zionist regime's destruction of civilian infrastructure in Gaza, including tens of thousands of housing units, in addition to hospitals, schools, mosques, bakeries, water pipes, sewage and electricity networks, threatens to make the continuation of the Palestinian life in Gaza impossible. Experts said that intentional starvation amounts to a war crime. Under the United States pressure, the Zionist regime reopened the Karam Abu Salem commercial crossing in southern Gaza recently, which would allow for the transfer of additional humanitarian aid stockpiling in Egypt. Aid agencies say, however, that Israeli regime airstrikes make it impossible to deliver aid. Juliet Tuma, spokesperson for UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, recently told British Broadcasting Corporation that you can't deliver aid under a sky full of airstrikes. Meanwhile, crowds have stopped trucks entering Gaza via Rafah crossing on the Egyptian border and offloaded aid, an indication of the severe desperation that has set in after more than 70 days of intensive bombardment and siege. The humanitarian situation is particularly dire for Palestinians stranded in areas where the Zionist regime occupying forces are deployed, three prominent human rights groups said. The Israeli regime military is denying the Palestine Red Crescent and the International Committee of the Red Cross access to those areas, thereby hindering the crucial delivery of medical aid and preventing the evacuation of casualties. Nearly 36 Palestinian civil defense workers have been killed and over 100 injured since October 7th. Recently, the Zionist regime forces targeted and killed three civil defense workers, along with Al Jazeera cameraman Samer Abu Daqa, while attempting to evacuate a family in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, even after the military gave permission for them to enter the area. Abu Daqa bled out for hours as the Israeli regime forces obstructed paramedics from reaching him and rendering assistance. Al Jazeera bureau chief Wael al-Dahdu was injured in the drone strike that killed Abu Daqa. Elsewhere in Gaza, another journalist, Al-Mashat correspondent Muhammad Baloucha, was shot in both of his legs shortly after Abu Daqa was fatally injured. He had to wait hours before rescuers were able to reach and evacuate him. He's reportedly in a stable condition. Weeks earlier, Baloucha documented the grim discovery of decomposing bodies of several babies who died in their hospital beds, still attached to medical devices, 17 days after the Zionist regime forced the evacuation of An-Nasr Pediatric Hospital at gunpoint. Three Palestinian human rights organizations, including Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, say that they have documented incidents in which Palestinians died from their injuries after Israeli regime ground forces blocked ambulances from reaching them. The three groups said in these dire circumstances, civilians find themselves unable to access any medical treatment for their injuries. Rescue teams are unable to reach those in need or retrieve the bodies of those killed. In certain areas, thousands of Palestinian bodies remain under the rubble and on the streets, inaccessible and unretrieved. This not only leaves their families in anguish, unable to ascertain their whereabouts and grieve properly, but also presents a significant risk of the spread of serious diseases among the population. Bodies that are recovered are being buried in the nearest available sites, according to the groups, including gardens, marketplaces, and roadway medians. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said recently that Israeli regime artillery fire had hit the maternity ward of the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, leading to several casualties. The health ministry in Gaza, Al Jazeera and Palestinian outlets reported that 12-year-old Dunya Abu Mohsen, who was being treated for an amputated foot, was killed in the strike. Video recorded inside the hospital showing a chaotic scene in a smoke-filled room as men carry away an evidently killed person. Photos of the site of the strike show holes blown into the walls and a pillow stained with blood. Also recently, the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza stated that Israeli regime forces had stormed Al-Aula Hospital, which has been under siege for several days. Medical staff, as well as patients and their companions, have been shot by Israeli regime military snipers at the hospital, killing a nurse and a pregnant woman's sister-in-law as they arrived at the facility for medical services. The ministry said recently that medical staff had been stripped, detained, and interrogated for hours before being released. The hospital's director, Ahmad Mohanna, was abducted and taken to an unknown destination. Recently, the ministry said that the Zionist regime was abducting 38 health workers from Gaza, including Muhammad Abu Salmiya, the director of Ashifa Hospital. In northern Gaza, Israeli occupation forces withdrew from Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia after storming it and abducting its director and medical staff. Medical staff came under fire while delivering a press conference in the hospital's courtyard. Video shows the staff ducking for safety as shots ring out while one of them was reading out a statement about an Israeli regime attack the previous day. Recently, the Israeli regime military reportedly used a bulldozer to raise tents belonging to displaced people sheltering in the hospital courtyard. Al Jazeera interviewed witnesses who said civilians were deliberately targeted in the bulldozer attack and buried alive. Videos shared on social media show body parts sticking out of the rubble in front of the hospital and tire tracks from heavy machinery in the sand. The Palestinian groups Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights said that Israeli regime forces had carried out extensive excavations inside the hospital courtyard. They exhumed a mass grave in which the bodies of 26 people were buried. The rights groups called for an independent international investigation into the serious violations at Kamal Adwan Hospital and the Zionist regime's targeting of health facilities across Gaza. Israeli regime shelling destroyed the hospital's pharmacy, doctors at Kamal Adwan told Al Jazeera, and some patients died during the Zionist regime siege due to a lack of medical supplies and a lack of clean water. Tedros Adhanom, the head of the World Health Organization, said that during the attack on Kamal Adwan, many patients had to self-evacuate at great risk to their health and safety, with ambulances unable to reach the facility. Of the at least 8 patients who perished during the siege, several died due to lack of adequate health care, including a 9-year-old child. Adhanom said that WHO is extremely concerned for the displaced people who are sheltering at the hospital, but did not comment on the reported bulldozer attack in the facility's courtyard. He added, Gaza's health system was already on its knees, and the loss of another even minimally functioning hospital is a severe blow. The Zionist regime's military published a crude propaganda video purporting to show weapons that were hidden incubators in Kamal Adwan's neonatal intensive care unit, claiming that the hospital was used by Hamas as a command center. Al-Ahli Hospital in Gaza City is the sole hospital out of 24 in northern Gaza Strip that remains partially functional after more than 2 months of Israeli regime strikes and siege. 3 other hospitals remain only minimally functional, according to WHO.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the issues about children and youth according to the Islamic teachings and ahadith. Today we have Sister Salma, who has been talking to us about some very important points. Sister Salma, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to our show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
Sister Salma, you have been telling us about how it's so necessary to, you know, kind of bring that environment for a child to become more studious. And some of the things that you said that were very important was that don't make them feel that studies are, you know, hindering their hobbies, and help them be more organized. This organization is going to help them throughout their life, and don't make it too strict. So do you have any more points to add?
Yes. Encourage your child's achievements. Even if they achieve a score that was more than the, you know, previous score, but it's still less, for example, you always have to appreciate that, that, you know, that those 3 points were more like as in my score.
Yeah.
I tried so hard and we tried together. Look, we got the achievement. And Allah is there to help us. Even now, we can do more than this. And, you know, get it so, like, something so beautiful, a feeling in his heart that they never, you know, lag behind working and, you know, keeping on working ahead to get more and more. Another point that we should need to realize is that focus on the strengths of the person. And this is more or less the same way in the achievements of the person. Focus on the strengths.
Yeah.
Whatever they are good at. You know, for example, if they may be good at art, for example, focus on that. Know that, you know, like, appreciate the fact that they do so good art, you know, that can be so, you know, like, beneficial for them in the future. Or anything, creativity-wise. Or maybe they are so good at speech, maybe, or they're so good at reciting, or they're so good at Quran. Focus on that more, so they know that they have one point, you know,
yeah,
to lean on.
And maybe give them opportunities.
Yeah,
to,
give them, know, opportunities, exactly,
show it.
To show that. Yeah, that's true. And then another last but not least, we must say that make every day a learning day, and that's very beautiful. Never forget that, you know, Allah has created us in this time span, and every moment that we don't think of Allah, we will regret on that day, like Imam Baqir alayhi salam says. So in actuality, every moment that we don't have knowledge and don't learn more, then we will regret on that day. Because learning more makes a mind astute and think more, and of course get broad-minded, the right education, of course, the right way to impart education. All these things needs to really be taken into consideration. So every day should be a learning process. Every moment even should be a learning process. If not every moment, everything that we do should be a learning process. So it makes a person more reflective, more reflect, you know. They say that a person who reflects on everything and takes ibrah from it, Allah's mercy descends on him. Of course, Allah's mercy is always descending, but we containers will grasp that mercy. So it's very important that anything we do, for example, if we are cooking, we are learning as well. If we are, for example, learning, we are learning as well.
Yeah.
If we are reading a story, we are learning as well. If we are playing football, also that we are learning how to be more balanced and how to run more. Or, you know, any exercise we are doing, we are learning as well. So we should not, you know, like, feel, exclude, you know, luxury from knowledge.
True.
Yeah, that luxury should be even of knowledge. And this is very, something that is very hard to do. You need to be polished on that. You need to read on that. A parent needs to find
yourself
out, remind yourself, and also practice. Practice makes perfect, of course. So inshallah, little by little, our children will become angels around the world and start, you know, benefiting the whole world, inshallah, which we want, yeah, when we pray, Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyatina qurrata a'ini waj'alna lil muttaqina imama, when we pray for our spouses and children to be the imam of the muttaqin, how they will be polished, their knowledge will grow.
Yeah.
So it starts with this, giving them that encouragement to learn even in school, but to learn even outside school, to polish their other potentials, to make everything a learning experience, to not let a day go by without learning, or a moment, you know, that is useful for him to learn, point that out for him, share it out, show your enthusiasm so that he can also get that positive energy. Inshallah, that
Inshallah.
He will succeed in that. And this mother, this parent will also succeed in encouraging the child to learn more.
Definitely. I feel like we learned a lot. I'm sure this parent is going to be able to work on, you know, getting their child to like studying because of all these very interesting and important points that you've given us. And I think one thing that kind of caps it is that kind of bringing this confidence into the child. Once all of this happens, all of this is done, the child's confidence, etemad benafs, you know, grows so much that they feel that they can reach up to the stars. And I feel like, unfortunately, a lot of people who don't have this confidence miss out on so much. So being a good parent is so important. Inshallah, we learn and try and be those kind of parents, inshallah.
Sure.
We're just going to take a short break and we'll be continuing soon after.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and we have been discussing about some very interesting questions. So somebody came with this question and said, what should a teacher do when he has a class of 10-year-olds creating a lot of noise time and again? At times it gets very difficult to control such children.
Yeah, and especially in the classes when there's a teacher who is supposed to take maybe a 3-hour long class, of course at intervals, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, I suggest that he should have no space in his timetable. For example, of course, apart from the breaks that they have, he should, in that 1 hour or 40-50 minute class, he should not let the children just be doing other things.
Okay.
For example, apart from what is, for example, sometimes it happens that the homework is checked, you know, so the teacher moves around and sees every child's homework. So at that time, you should give the other children activities to do.
Yes.
You know? So, for example, he's marking the first child's paper, so the others should be doing activities. When he goes to the second one, the first one should just also start doing his activities. So there should be no space for them to create an uproar and mischief and throwing things at one another and exchanging letters. This happens more obviously. Another thing is that to maintain the awe and respect of the teacher should not disconnect himself from the students.
Okay.
He should always have this rapport with them, you know, like keep on talking to them. For example, if he's giving them the activity, he should move around and say things like, remember to write very neatly. Okay, I'm going to check that too.
Yeah.
Or then, I hope you slept well. You should be alert in this because you need to think more. So move around and keep on saying small statements so that the children can be forced to be alert.
Yeah.
And keep on feeling the fact that the presence of the teacher is counted. So we can't make any mischief in the midst. Okay? So this is very important. Also, time and again, the teacher should have this kind of relationship with the students to make them feel lighthearted and happy.
Yeah.
So he shouldn't be so strict that the children feel very scared of, or he shouldn't be so friendly that he should be like the age mate of the children.
Yeah. No. They'll take advantage of him.
Yeah, exactly. He should be in between, you know, in perfect equilibrium, doing his things, yet at the same time, having this awe and respect for himself that the children cannot take advantage of him. And I think that's about it, that how children can really start respecting him. And of course, at the right moments, even if the child needs to go to places like the restroom, he should allow them so that the child doesn't feel frustrated, you know. Or if the child, there's a certain child creating problem, he can nicely tell the child that I want to also share your conversation with you. Can you involve me? And the child will feel scared. This is not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Or can I share the joke with you?
Mm.
So he knows where strictness is applied and where friendliness is applied. At the same time that he's very, easygoing with the children, as in talking to them, reminding them things, smiling with them. But he knows he's strict in his own way. So he can't be taken advantage of. But it's a hard task.
Yeah, it's
to become a teacher of one class for three or 4 hours consecutively. Yeah, if it's a 1 hour class or a 50 minute class and the teachers keep on changing, then, you know, even the students find it easier.
Yeah.
But in lower classes, we don't have that. We have one teacher for all the subjects through. As you go to higher classes, then we have special teachers for different subjects because they get harder, right?
I think like having that command into the in the class, not that, like you said, not overly strict, but not overly friendly. We're just going to take another short break and we'll be continuing soon after.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. I think a lot of the times when we were young, I used to really look up to my teachers who were such, like not those who are too friendly, but those who are kind of, I used to feel in awe of them, you know, oh, yeah. This teacher has something,
yeah.
You know, I want to please him, I want to do well, so he praises me. I feel like this kind of character has to be built, has to be worked on.
That charisma has to be there and it grows as a teacher, you know, they need to know their limits also to have certain kind of conversations with the students and what not to have, what conversations not to have. And the children, if there's a problematic child also, the teacher can have other ways to, you know, implement that to make the child perform better in his behavior in his class. And all that is possible, of course, with this kind of behavior that, you know, you have to know that the children are not taken for granted and they notice everything. So you have to have this relationship continuously with them and not take them as little or not be indifferent to them. Sometimes children find themselves not being cared for, you know, in the school. That the child teacher doesn't care about how I write, but the teacher should notice everything. Even call him aside and tell him that, you know, next time write better. Or choose a person who's even sitting last, that you come up and I want to know what you wrote today. You know, read out aloud like of what you
Involve them, make them involve feel they're part of
each and every one of them, you know. We sometimes just involve the clever person or we just involve the person who is not clever at all or, you know, he can't study properly. We don't involve everyone together. So all the children together being involved really creates a good, you know, like a good appearance for the teacher. And his reputation.
And I feel even like maintaining that. Eye contact and trying to have eye contact with as many children as possible. I think a lot of people feel frustrated when they're not being looked at. So they feel like, okay, we are not really looked at as part of this class. You know, the teacher doesn't like us so much. So thank you very much. And it was very lovely talking about these very important, you know, topics, and we hope to continue this inshallah in the next episode. Dear audience, thank you very much for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.ir. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems, Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.